Kane started to leave the infirmary, and then remembered he intended to ask DeFore to put together a first aid kit for them by the next morning. Peering into the adjoining room, he expected to see the medic at Domi's bedside. To his surprise and unease, he saw Quavel there, apparently standing vigil. The hybrid woman dabbed at Domi's forehead with a moist cloth. The albino girl, now under the comforting influence of sedatives, murmured to her in wordless gratitude. Kane watched the two women for a moment, struck again by their resemblance to one another and how their vast differences had actually brought them together, as if completing a circle that began at opposite poles. Unlike himself, Grant, and Brigid, the only life path Domi had abandoned when she'd joined Cerberus was the marginal existence of an outlander, and later as Guanateague's sex slave. Born into a raw, wild world, outlanders were accustomed to living on the edge of death. Grim necessity had taught them the skills to survive, even thrive, in the post-nuke environment. They may have been the great-great-great-grandchildren of civilized men and women, but they had no choice but to embrace lives of semi-barbarism. They were tough and vicious and quite possibly the last genuine human beings on the planet. Sneered at by the elite of the Vils, viewed as little more than expendable dray animals, outlanders were an endangered species. As a magistrate, Kane had chilled dozens of them in the performance of his duty, but he had murdered more than their bodies. He had destroyed their spirits as well. He had killed them, body and soul, because he was carrying out the will of the barons, the hybridized god-kings who had inherited the earth from their human cousins, whom they scorned as ape-kin. The hybrids, at least by their way of thinking, represented the final phase of human evolution. They referred to themselves as new humans and empowered themselves to control not only their immediate environment, but also the evolution of other species. The barons did so by planning and creating wholesale alterations in living organisms, changing evolutionary patterns to suit themselves. They considered themselves the pinnacle of evolutionary achievement, as high above ordinary hybrids as the hybrids were above mere humans. As unaware as Domi was of their existence until she joined Cerberus, she learned to hate the barons with the same zeal that Kane did. They woke up hating the hybrids and the barons, and they went to bed hating the hybrids and the barons. Although Domi despised the breed of so-called new human on general principles, she reserved her most unregenerate hatred for the breed of old human that willingly served them. As far as she was concerned, they were worse than traitors to their own kind. They were groveling, submissive lapdogs and deserved no mercy. When she encountered them, she offered none. Waif-like in appearance she might be, but Domi had proved time and again that she was anything but a child. Then both Kane and Domi had been apprehended while penetrating Area 51. Whereas he was imprisoned by the forces of Baron Kobold, Domi had actually been rescued by an insurrectionist fifth column made up of humans and hybrids, led by Quavel, whom Domi had been restrained from killing some months before during the Archuleta Mesa mission. Over a period of time, Domi realized that her hatred of the hybrids and barons was derived primarily from what Quavel referred to as negative conditioning. To end the war between human and hybrid, Quavel explained, the conditioning had to be faced and overcome by both factions. Domi had remembered conversations between Lakesh and Brigid Baptiste about how the similarity between Balaam's folk and the hybrids and the traditional myth images of demons accounted for the instant enmity that sprang up between humans and the so-called Archons. Lakesh opined that since ancient depictions of imps, elves, and djinn were more than likely based on early encounters between Balaam's people and primitive man, humans weren't capable of reaching an accord with creatures who resembled archetypal figures of evil. Even by crossbreeding with humans, the hybrids were still markedly different from humankind. But as Quavel pointed out, different was not the same as alien. She herself confessed that her own race viewed humans as savages, little more than bloodthirsty apes who were incapable of transcending their roots as killers. She had other experiences with humans as well, specifically with Kane. While Quavel's group of insurgents had found Domi, Baron Kobold sentenced Kane to what amounted to stud service. The mission that destroyed Archuleta Mesa had also virtually wiped out the genetic engineering division of the vast facility. What remained of the place, both in personnel and machinery, was transferred to the much larger Area 51 facility. The necessary equipment and raw material to implement procreation had yet to be installed. Baron Cobalt had unilaterally decided that the conventional means of conception was the only option to keep the hybrid race alive. Since the Baron held Cain responsible for pushing the hybrid race to the brink of extinction, he made it his task to repopulate it as well. Cain wasn't the first human male to be pressed into service. There had been other men before him, but they had performed unsatisfactorily due to their terror of the hybrids. Cain's sense of surprise was still fresh when he recollected how Quavel, during one of their scheduled periods of copulation, had confided to him that not every hybrid agreed with the baronial policy toward humanity. He was even more surprised when she'd helped him and Domi escape. Both of them were forced to reassess everything they'd thought they'd known about the Barons, about the hybrids. Quavel suddenly sensed his presence in the doorway and lifted her eyes, her crystal blue penetrating gaze fixed on his face. Her expression remained the same, one of a calm, almost serene detachment. Resisting the impulse to withdraw, he nodded to her instead. She didn't react for a long moment, then she returned the nod with just a hint of the arrogant hybrid superiority he had learned to despise.
Quavel, you and I need to talk.
Indeed.
She started to move toward him.
When I get back.
Cain turned and left, hoping he didn't appear to be in a hurry. His mind wheeled with memories, fears, and conjectures. He recalled how Quavel had reacted when he'd questioned her in Area 51, as if it were truly possible for humans and hybrids to procreate. Although she claimed they were chromosomally compatible, she had admitted the procedure was still experimental. Then Quavel had smiled at him in a way he could only interpret as coquettish. One of her long fingers had traced the faint scar on his left cheek.
But some of us here, me at least, find the process of trial and error very enjoyable.
The most recent memory of Quavel was not hazy in the least, though he wished it were. He still recalled with shocking vividness his first sight of her nearly 2 months before, sitting in Lakish's office when he had entered to brief him about the events that had occurred on the moon. Cain would have imbibed battery acid before admitting that it was the closest he had ever come to fainting dead away. As it was, his knees had almost buckled, but he was able to attribute his weakness to injuries inflicted upon him by McCann. According to Quavel, she had made the long overland trip from Area 51 in a stolen sandcat, all alone. She'd traveled as far as the foothills of the Bitterroot Range to the encampment of Skydog. The shaman brought her the rest of the way to the mountain peak on horseback. Both Cain and Lakesh were still skeptical of certain details of her story, particularly how she knew the location of the redoubt. She offered only a vague explanation about hearing it from either Cain or Domi during their period of imprisonment in Dreamland. She had refused to name which one of them actually made the revelation. Neither Cain nor Domi admitted to telling her or anyone else about Cerberus. Still, Quavel had provided them with information about the current state of the baronies following the Imperator War, although little of it could be confirmed. Quavel's presence in the redoubt made Cain distinctly uncomfortable, since the entire situation evoked unpleasant memories of Lakesh's abortive plan to turn Cerberus from a sanctuary to a colony. To that end, babies needed to be born, ones with superior genes. Making a unilateral decision, Lakesh had arranged for a woman named Beth Lee Rauch to be brought into the redoubt from one of the baronies to mate with Cain, to ensure that his superior abilities were passed on to offspring. Without access to the techniques of fetal development outside the womb that were practiced in the Vills, the conventional means of procreation was the only option, and that meant sex and passion and the fury of a woman scorned. Cain had refused to cooperate for a variety of reasons, primarily because he felt the plan was a continuation of sinister elements that had brought about the new cost and the tyranny of the Vills. His refusal had had tragic consequences. Only a thirst for revenge and a conspiracy to murder had been birthed within the walls of the redoubt, not children. And now Beth Lee was dead, killed by Domi and buried in a simple grave out on the hillside. Cain could only pray Quavel's involvement in the lives of the Cerberus residents didn't have similarly tragic consequences. At 0600, they convened in the ready room, which held the jump chamber. Bridget, Cain, and Grant had made their preparations the night before, filling flat cases with special equipment, rations, and water. All three of them wore the hard suits they had brought down from the moon. The one-piece garments were fairly tight-fitting and relatively lightweight, barely 30 pounds apiece. The hard suits consisted of 10 layers of aluminized mylar insulation interlaced with 6 layers of Dacron and tough outer facings of a bronze-colored Kevlar to blunt any impacts that might penetrate the microenvironment provided by the suits. They carried the helmets under their arms. Dark bronze in color like the suits, the helmets were made of a lightweight ceramic alloy compound. The treated plexiglass faceplates polarized when exposed to light levels above a certain candle power. Equipped with sealed water dispensers and sipping tubes attached to the interior walls, the helmets allowed freedom of movement for their heads, even though they did limit peripheral vision. They could communicate with each other over UTEL radio systems. Small secondary oxygen tanks were attached to the back of the headpieces. The design allowed for the venting of exhaled air directly into the environment, much like scuba gear. Venting from the helmet reduced the collection of moisture on the inner faceplate. The only modifications Kane and Grant had made to the spacesuits were the adjustment of the seals between sleeves and gloves to permit the addition of their sin eaters. The fingers of the gloves were flexible enough to pick up coins from a carpeted floor. Their combat daggers hung in scabbards from web belts. Brigid carried one of the tungsten carbide rail pistols brought from the moon base and added to the Cerberus arsenal. She tucked the weapon into a holster on her belt. The EVA suits were hot, so they each wore form-fitting shadow suits beneath them as well. They were climate-controlled for environments up to highs of 150 degrees and as low as minus 10 degrees Fahrenheit. Microfilaments controlled the internal temperature. An extremely nervous Filboid checked the seals of the EVA suits and made sure the oxygen tanks worked.
I admit I don't understand everything about the gateways, but Mars seems a damn long way for a gateway jump. If it would take nearly half a year to get there by Manta.
Distance is relative when you're dealing with quantum physics. There's no relativistic range limitation on hyperdimensions. The gateways form interstices and interfaces between linear points, regardless of the distance between them. Utilizing hyperdimensional space, there's little difference between jumping from a MATRANS unit in Cuba and one in Australia. The same principle applies to the gateway here and the one on Mars.
Hell. Why are we bothering with this trip at all? We don't need Lakesh back, not with that dead-on imitation Bri can perform.
Once Project Cerberus began mass-producing the MATRANS gateways as modular units, conventional spacecraft were rendered virtually obsolete, since the gateways permitted swift and relatively easy movement of personnel and materiel back and forth from Earth. A MATRANS gateway was installed on the space station Parallax Red, and experiments were conducted regarding the teleportation of gateway components through space along carrier waveguides placed at equidistant intervals to the projected destination. This method allowed travel to the inner planets of the solar system without using conventional spacecraft. The waveguides launched from Parallax Red provided an almost instantaneous method of reaching Mars.
I've got all the coordinates encoded. All you have to do is shut the door.
I don't know if I should envy you or feel sorry for you.
We've been there already. Feel sorry for us.
Filboid gestured toward the helmets under their arms.
You won't need to put those on?
No. The Cydonia Gateway Unit is located in a habitat with synthetic gravity and an Earth-normal atmosphere. We won't even need the EVA suits unless we go out on the surface. We're wearing them just in case.
Oh. Well, in that case, good luck all.
The three people trooped into the jump chamber. Above the keypad and coding panel hung an imprinted notice dating back to pre-dark days. In faded maroon lettering, it read, "Entry absolutely forbidden to all but B-12 cleared personnel." Kane used to wonder why Lakesh hadn't removed the sign, but he figured the man probably applied the same reasons to keeping the illustration of the three-headed hound intact. Nostalgia could manifest itself in very curious ways. They took their places on the hexagonal floor plates, and Kane pulled the door closed, initiating the automatic jump circuits. He noted that breathing rates increased, including his own.
You know, you haven't said it in a long time.
Said what?
You know, what you always used to say before we made a gateway jump. Your mantra.
Grant tried to shrug, but it wasn't easy in the EVA suit.
I only said it before I got used to making the jumps. They don't bother me now.
Oh, really?
Really.
The hexagonal floor and ceiling plates shimmered silver. A fine, faint mist gathered at their feet and drifted down from the ceiling. Thready static discharges, like tiny lightning strokes, arced through the vapor. The mist thickened, blotting out everything. Shadows seemed to creep into Kane's vision from all corners. The sound of breathing faded, ebbing away into silence. Right before Kane's hearing shut down altogether, Grant's strained, faraway whisper filtered into his ears.
I hate these fucking things.
First, the entire universe seemed to explode in a blaze of force. From the hyperdimensional non-space through which they had been traveling, they seemed to fall through bottomless abysses. There was a micro-instant of non-existence, then a sharp, wrenching shock, and their senses returned. Kane stared up at the pattern of silver discs on the ceiling and realized they were diamond-shaped rather than the familiar hexagonal configuration, which meant the phase transit had been successful. Trying to focus through the last of the mist wisping over his eyes, Kane silently endured the nausea churning and rolling in his stomach. He knew if he waited it out, he wouldn't vomit, but it would take another couple of minutes to regain his emotional equilibrium. No human being, no matter how thoroughly briefed in advance, could be expected to remain unflappable on a hyperdimensional trip through the gateway. 1 second a person was in the relativistic here, surrounded by glowing mist, and in the next second all eternity seemed to cave in. Perceptions changed, time jumped, and for a heart-stopping instant the cosmos at large seemed to stand still. Then the traveler was wherever the transmitter had been programmed to send him. Whatever else, a trip through the gateway was unsettling to the mind, to the nerves, and to the soul itself, as Kane had personal reason to know.
It looks like we made it.
Yeah, I guessed that when I noticed we weren't puking our guts out.
Kane turned his head, squeezing his eyes shut against the momentary wave of vertigo that blurred his vision. When he opened them, he saw Grant and Bridget carefully hiking themselves up to sitting positions. Fading tendrils of vapor wreathed their bodies, a plasma byproduct of what Lakish referred to as the quincunx effect. The floor plate pattern duplicated that of the ceiling. The jump chamber was small, about half the standard size. The dark blue color of the armorglass walls allowed only the dimmest light to penetrate from outside.
Yeah, looks like the same one I remember. I say something funny.
Do you ever?
Kane reflected how he and his friends now accepted the reality of almost instantaneous travel across the solar system as routine, when only a couple of years before, all of their minds had been completely boggled by their first Mat-Trans jump, a distance of a few hundred miles from Colorado to Montana. After helping Bridget to her feet, Kane sniffed the air experimentally and found it cold, even a little stale, but still breathable. Grant didn't bother, since his sense of smell was seriously impaired due to suffering several broken noses throughout his life. Bridget rocked experimentally on the balls of her feet.
The grav statters are still working.
I guess the transadapts are still pulling pay. Let's find out.
By 1/2 inches, Kane nudged the door open with a boot, pausing to listen. Stepping up beside him, Bridget lifted her left wrist. Strapped around it was a small device made of molded black plastic and stamped metal. A liquid crystal display window exuded a faint glow. The motion detector registered no movement within the radius of its invisible sensor beams. He heard nothing, so he pushed the door wide and saw what he expected to see. A small room with cream-colored walls, a cabinet with shattered glass doors and dark bloodstains on the floor. The last time he'd seen the room, Sindri's chief lieutenant, the venomous transadapt David, lay bleeding to death at the base of the jump chamber. Apparently, a few of his brethren had attended to his body and done what they could to scrub away the mess. Kane took the point as he usually did, carrying his helmet under his arm. He walked carefully, heel to toe, leading with his sin-eater until he reached the open doorway. The room beyond was small and dimly lit, more of a foyer. A turnstile security checkpoint occupied most of the opposite wall. Bridget came to his side, performed another motion detector sweep, and one at a time they pushed through the prongs of the checkpoint and into a narrow tube tunnel. The passageway was very quiet, as if upon entering they had stepped into a vault that hoarded only silence. Kane eased out into the shaft, walking heel to toe in the characteristic way of a mag penetrating a potential kill zone. The right-hand walls were perforated at regular intervals with large, round iris hatches. The first hatch they came to opened into a partitioned office suite filled with desks and computer terminals. Tacked onto a bulletin board near the door were dozens of memos, each one bearing the legend, "By Order of the Committee of 100. The second hatch opened up into a big room that contained a raised dais supporting a lectern that looked out over 10 rows of chairs. They knew it was the council chamber of the ruling committee of the colony. All three of them recalled what Sindri had told them about the governmental setup of the Cydonia colony, which had actually gotten its start on Parallax Red. In the late 20th century, shortly after the photographic discoveries of the monuments of Mars by the Viking Mars probe, construction had begun in secret on a space habitat located in Lagrange Region 2 on the far side of the moon. Originally, the project had been a covert joint undertaking between America and Russia under the authority of the Totality Concepts over Project Majestic. Parallax Red, envisioned as an elite community with a maximum population of 5,000, was intended as a utopia for the best of Earth transported into space. The station provided a jumping-off point for the colonists building the permanent outpost on the Cydonia plains of Mars. However, because of the chaos engendered by the nuke cost and the damage the space station sustained by Russian killer satellites, both the fledgling Martian colony and Parallax Red were forgotten. The personnel of the station had had no choice but to move permanently to Mars. They'd formed a caste-based society built on the labor of the transadapts. They'd also explored their new home world, particularly the mile-high D&M pyramid, named after DiPietro and Molinar, the two NASA photo analysts who discovered it on the Viking transmissions. The massive pyramid served the Twaha de Danann as the cornerstone of their ancient culture, and within it the colonists came across the leavings of their once mighty science, all of it based on sound and vibration. They'd found a small harp-like device, which was a microscopic version of a truly gargantuan instrument occupying the uppermost level of the structure. The pyramid was more than a monument. It was a gigantic broadcasting tower, transmitting a frequency too subtle for human ears, but deadly to the Archons. Sindri had referred to it as a song that played eternally, blanketing the entire planet, penetrating every nook and cranny of Mars, and forming an invisible sonic wall that forever barred Archon entry. Sindri had theorized the true purpose beyond the Cydonia colony in the 20th century was to locate the source of the song and stop it. He believed the Archons supported and abetted a Terran colony on Mars, so by proxy they would still conquer Mars, reclaiming it from the Twaha de Danann. Brigid, Kane, and Grant had learned much later that Sindri's overall theory was wrong, although close to the truth in some particulars. In any event, as the 21st century became the 22nd and edged toward the 23rd, the transadapt population of the Cydonia compound had continued to grow, eventually outnumbering the human population by at least 3-1. Only their much shorter lifespans had prevented them from completely controlling the colony. One of the descendants of the original human colonists devoted his life to divining the purpose of the Danann infrasound emitter in the pyramid. Micah Harwin postulated that the device transmitted not a signal, but a frequency that blanketed the entire planet. As it turned out, solving that mystery became Harwin's only reason for living. When Sindri was born, genetic testing determined that he was the offspring of a transadapt mother and Harwin. He possessed far more Earth-human characteristics than transadapt, except for his short, though perfectly proportioned, stature. Sindri's mother died shortly after his birth, and his father was exiled from the Cydonia compound for the crime of miscegenation. Making the D&M pyramid his home, Harwin experimented with the frequencies of the Danann transmitter and accidentally, or intentionally, no one really knew, altered the harmonics so that the human colonists became infertile over a period of time. It was Sindri himself, as an adult, who had discovered this and brought it to the ruling committee, urging an exodus back to Earth before the entire human population of the colony became extinct. Rather than accept Sindri's proposal, the dwindling number of human colonists had devised a plan to ensure they would not eventually be outnumbered or outlived by the transadapts. Having already instituted a form of apartheid by segregating the transadapts into their own habitats, the humans used a medical treatment disguised as necessary vaccinations to make the transadapts barren. Since the transadapts had been engineered to have shorter lifespans than humans, it was conceivable that they could all be dead within a single generation. Sindri had led an open, bloody revolution against the human population of Cydonia. At the end of a month, all of the human colonists and 3/4 of the transadapts had perished by violence. The oppressive silence made the passageways feel haunted by the ghosts of all the people who had died during the Cydonia struggle. Bridget, Grant, and Kane followed corridors lit by luminous neon bands that ran along the curved ceiling. Soon, they reached an intersection.
Where do we go from here?
If I recall correctly, this way leads to the residential habitats.
The three walked for a score of yards in silence. When they reached a wide, outward-bulging niche in the tunnel wall, Bridget stopped and touched a button. A shutter slid up, affording them an exterior view of the compound. The mid-morning light came through the transparent port, the sun hovering a hand's breadth over the rust-red horizon in a salmon-pink sky. Beyond a fenced-in perimeter spread a seemingly endless desert of orange-red sand. Low ridges rose naked from the desolate landscape and grew into a distant, barren mountain range. Many miles to the west rose a vast bulk of stone, a smoothly contoured formation that resembled a slightly squashed mesa. Wind-blown sand had piled high in drifts all around the perimeter of the colony. Windmills, water towers, trenches, and solar reflectors were placed in functional patterns. Clusters of domes made of dull metal humped up from the sand like half-buried balls. Each was connected to the others by tubes composed of the same material. Domes with translucent plastic roofs covered blurry green areas, which they guessed were vegetable gardens. In the far distance, they saw a range of stone shouldering up from rock-strewed and barren ground. Lowering his gaze, Kane saw a small object squatting on the ground between two of the tube tunnels. Flat-topped and suspended by an assembly of tread-enclosed rollers, it looked vaguely like a toy version of a sandcat. The machine rested in exactly the same position as he had last seen it when Sindri had identified it as the Mars Pathfinder, landed by NASA in the late 1990s. According to him, the mission had been a cover story to help to quell rumors they were deliberately concealing facts from the American citizenry about the discovery of ancient Martian artifacts. Within the perimeter of the fence, rust-hued sand spread, piling up in dunes at the bases of the domes. A few of the habitats were larger than others, their exteriors faintly etched with window lines. They contained barracks, manufacturing facilities, and even nurseries for transadapt children. A rusty patina of granules covered every surface. At least once every Martian year, hurricane-force winds whipped up vast dust storms all over the surface of the planet. When Mars was closest to the sun, the storms developed in the southern hemisphere and the winds roared across the desert at 300 miles per hour.
Place looks about as inviting as the last time we visited.
Kane pointed out through the portal.
Those look new. They're not covered by dust anyway.
Resting on the ground on the opposite side of the fence, about 100 yards away, they saw an array of long, open, flat-decked craft with low sidewalls. They resembled pics of bobsleds Kane had seen, but were about twice as big.
What are they?
Who cares? I'm more interested in where the transadapts might have gotten to.
On Parallax Red, maybe?
Maybe. But after the damage we caused the last time we were there, I don't think there are enough transadapts to manage major repairs. The station wouldn't have been able to sustain the entire colony.
Then they've got to be someplace. Either here, or...
Here or where? The pyramid?
That would be my guess.
The three people began walking again.
I'm a lot less interested in the whereabouts of the transadapts than McCann and his crew.
I have a feeling that if we find the one, we'll find the other. Oh, Bridget, have you given any more thought to a connection between the interphaser and the pyramid?
I have, but I want to look at the structure first and refresh my memory before I put my theory into words and leave myself open to ridicule.
Now, who would do that, Baptiste?
I can't imagine. You've always proved yourself so foursquare supportive of all my flights of fancy.
Please, my modesty.
Doesn't lend itself to close inspection, Kane.
She smiled to let him know she was only joking. When she and Kane were first thrown together, their relationship had been volatile, marked by frequent quarrels, jealousies, and resentments. The world in which she came of age was primarily quiet, focused on scholarly pursuits. Kane's world, wherein he'd become accustomed to daily violence, was supported by a belief system that demanded a ruthless single-mindedness to enforce baronial authority. Both people had their gifts. Most of what was important to people in the 22nd century came easily to Kane— survival skills, prevailing in the face of adversity, and cunning against enemies. But he could also be reckless, high-strung to the point of instability, and given to fits of rage. Bridget, on the other hand, was compulsively tidy and ordered, with a brilliant analytical mind. However, her clinical nature, the cool scientific detachment upon which she prided herself, sometimes blocked an understanding of the obvious human factor in any given situation. Regardless of their contrasting personalities, Kane and Bridget worked very well as a team, playing on each other's strengths rather than contributing to their individual weaknesses. Despite their differences, or perhaps because of them, the two people managed to forge the chains of partnership, which linked them together through mutual respect and trust. Only once had the links of that chain been stretched to a breaking point. More than a year before, Kane had shot and killed a woman, a distant relative of Bridget's, whom he'd perceived as a threat to her life. It had taken her some time to realize that under the confusing circumstances, Kane had had no choice but to make a snap judgment call. Making split-second life-and-death decisions was part of his conditioning and training in the Magistrate Division, as deeply ingrained as breathing. What conflicted her during that time was not the slow process of forgiving him, but coming to terms with what he really was and accepting the reality rather than an illusion. He was a soldier, not an explorer, an academic, or an intellectual. When she'd finally understood that about him, the two had achieved a synthesis of attitudes and styles where they functioned as colleagues and parts of a team, extending to the other professional courtesies and respect. As they followed a bend in the tube tunnel, the motion detector on Bridget's wrist suddenly emitted a discordant warning beep. They came to immediate halts, sin-eaters snapping up and questing for targets. Bridget stretched out her left arm, and the motion sensor screen lit up with a wavery green line. She swept the device slowly back and forth. The line slid from one side of the screen to the other, formed a dot, and froze in a central position. The dot shifted position, and the device emitted a second electronic beep.
Definitely a moving contact. Coming this way.
They waited in tense postures, fingers lightly touching the trigger studs of their pistols. Then the troll shambled around the bend, his spread-legged gait causing him to list slightly from side to side. He wasn't much more than 3.5 feet tall, his heavy-jawed face sunk between the broad yoke of his shoulders. His beady black eyes glittered from the shadows of deep sockets. Coarse, straight black hair fell over his retreating forehead. It bore streaks of gray. He wore a frayed coverall garment of drab olive green. Bridget inhaled sharply in startlement when she recognized him. His round gnome's head was still too large for his pipe-stem neck, and his tiny bare feet were still calloused an inch thick on the soles, with 9 long, undercurving toes on each one. The 10th toe was exceptionally long, nearly the length of the foot itself, projecting out at a 45-degree angle near the heel. It looked like a double-jointed thumb, topped by a yellow, horny nail caked with dirt to the cuticle. But the last time they had seen David, his abnormally long arms hadn't terminated in a pair of steel hooks that curved up from metal cups over the stumps of his wrists. If Kane had expected to encounter any of the transadapts, he certainly hadn't anticipated it would be David. The troll's blunt face reflected Kane's own surprise, and he recoiled, more from caution than fear of the three humans looming over him. The cold glitter in his black eyes betrayed the real hatred boiling away in the little man.
"Well, well. Little David, Sindri's chief hench dwarf and personal chef. I didn't expect to see you alive."
"I'd bet you didn't."
He held up his hooks.
"I almost wish you hadn't."
"I don't know what you're complaining about. You've got a whole extra set."
David's swart face screwed up as if he intended to spit at Grant, but he contented himself by balancing on one splayed foot and performing a passable imitation of giving Grant the finger with the middle toe of the other one. Kane indicated David's pair of hooks with the barrel of his sin-eater.
"Who fixed you up like that?"
"Sindri. Who else?"
"Right. Who else?"
David had lost his hands when he'd tried to prevent the three of them from getting out of the compound. He'd fired Bridget's appropriated Uzi at them, and Kane had had no choice but to return the fire with a blast of infrasound from an equally appropriated harp weapon. When the rounds of the subgun exploded, so had the transadapt's hands.
"I thought for sure you'd have bled to death."
"I imagine all the transadapts were bred with the ability to seal off epidermal punctures to protect the internal organs and tissues from the effects of zero pressure."
"What are you biggins doing back here? Sindri is long, long gone."
"We're not looking for Sindri. We know just where the little pissant is. We're looking for a friend."
A friend?
He was brought here against his will. I don't suppose you've seen him, have you?
And if I had, do you think I'd tell you?
Kane matched his smirk, taking a menacing step toward him.
Not without a little persuasion, which we're highly motivated to do.
David glared up at him. Then, with a burst of scuttling motion, he spun around and vanished down the passageway. Kane gaped in astonishment for a couple of seconds, nonplussed by the troll's speed, even though he had seen demonstrations of it from his kind in the past. Kane sprinted down the passageway. Bridget and Grant ran close behind him. Kane saw no sign of David, but he heard the rapid slap-slap of the troll's bare feet on the floor ahead of him. Once again, he was impressed by the speed of the transadapts. Although one of his strides equaled three made by David, the little man still eluded him. He decided when next he caught so much as a glimpse of David's shadow, he would open up with his Sin Eater. The passageway opened up into an intersection where the tube tunnels extended into four directions. Kane ran headlong into the hub.
Be careful! He could be leading us...
Kane caught glimpses of two small figures darting out of the mouths of the shafts. In his eagerness to strike the first blow, David leaped at Kane with both arms extended. The sharpened points of his hooks could have hamstrung the much larger man if Kane hadn't pivoted at the waist. He caught David by the left wrist and yanked him forward on his own momentum. He kicked him hard in the rear, sending him sprawling almost under the feet of Grant. As the troll tried to bound back to his feet, Grant drove the toe of a boot into his face. The sound of teeth splintering under the impact was loud and grisly in the confined space. David fell flat onto his back, uttering a gargling cry, blood spraying from his mouth. At the same instant, another transadapt, this one just as small but with a white blonde mop of shaggy hair, sprang at Kane. He struck savagely at his face with a long-handled instrument that resembled a three-clawed gardening tool. The prongs missed cutting furrows through Kane's eyes by a fractional margin, and the downstroke buried the points in the floor. As he struggled to wrench it free, Kane brought up his right knee and slammed the little man in the chest, knocking him backward. He staggered into the wall. The way was clear for Kane and Grant to open up with full auto fire, but the risk of puncturing the tube tunnel walls was very high. Besides, Kane wanted live sources of information, not dead gnomes. The blonde transadapt made a move to grasp the handle of his weapon, and Kane kicked at it. While he was still off balance, he felt steel-muscled arms encircle his knees. He went down heavily. David released Kane's legs and swung wildly with his hooks at Kane's face. Kane tried to fend the troll off, trying to catch him by the forearms to restrain him. The effort reminded him anew of just how deceptively strong the transadapts were. Bridget kneed David in the kidneys, slamming him over Kane's body and slapping him face first against a curved tunnel wall. Bridget pinned him there, knee against the small of his back, hands gripping his shoulders.
Stay there!
David's companion dropped into a crouch, his gleaming eyes darting back and forth uncertainly from Bridget to Grant to his weapon. Grant didn't wait for him to make up his mind. He leaped forward and kicked him hard in the belly. The little man folded up, his hair falling like a curtain over his face. Stepping around the pinioned David and prone Kane, Grant picked up the three-pronged tool, examined it with a critical eye, and tossed it contemptuously behind him, the way they had just come. Kane climbed to his feet.
All right. Enough of this ambush shit. You guys aren't any good at it.
Fuck you, biggin.
One day, I'm gonna get sick of being called that.
As far as I'm concerned, today is that day.
Kane released the transadapt, but David stayed on his feet, swaying unsteadily.
Where is Lakesh?
Don't know. We hid when they came.
They? How many were there?
Don't know. Not too many. All I know.
Kane stared down at the little man for a few thoughtful seconds and decided David wasn't lying to him. Too much.
All right. Take your pal and get the hell out of my sight. If I see you again before we leave, I'll kill you.
David pulled his comrade up and both of them backed away down a tube tunnel.
You'll die if you stay here.
We might. You definitely will.
The pair of transadapts scrambled out of sight.
My, that was easy.
What do you mean by that? He didn't tell us much of anything.
No, he didn't tell us much of anything. But what he didn't say is more helpful than what he did.
The three people began walking down the tunnel shaft again.
Explain.
Firstly, David didn't seem too interested when we told him we knew where Sindri was. That indicates he no longer follows him.
Which might mean he follows a new leader, like McCann.
David could have been coached to say what he did, but if McCann and his people aren't here in the compound, then it stands to reason that they're somewhere else on Mars.
The pyramid?
That's the only other place we know of on the planet that can sustain humanoid life.
Hell, we knew we'd be going there before we left Cerberus. So, let's get on with it.
Bridget, do you remember the way to the train station?
We'll see.
Bridget turned her head very slowly, trying to reconcile their surroundings with the memory of their last visit to the installation. She led them into the mouth of a tube tunnel opposite the one David and his fellow Transadapt had entered. She walked carefully, Grant and Kane following her. She opened one of the iris hatches and stepped through it into another branch of passageways, then to another hatch. This one was not in the wall, but in the floor. When its segments irised open, they saw a metal-runged ladder extending into a poorly lit semi-murk.
Well, this is the place.
Kane and Grant followed her. The climb was short, less than 12 feet, and they found themselves standing on a low-ceilinged platform. A dim yellow bulb cast its feeble rays on a dark, bullet-shaped vehicle resting upon a single raised rail. It was about 8 feet long, 6 in overall diameter. Hooked to it were two empty flat cars of about the same length. The track stretched out of sight down a long, round chute. Bridget touched an almost invisible button on its side, and a man-sized section of the hull slid open, revealing a hollow interior. The door panel lowered to form a short ramp. The interior of the bullet car held nothing but 4 padded seats. They entered and strapped themselves into the chairs, Kane and Bridget taking the first 2. Sindri had told them that the vehicle was automated, built by the Cydonia colonists to ferry them back and forth in relative safety across the Martian surface. There was nothing one could do once underway. Within a moment of buckling their seat harnesses, the hull panel slid shut, almost silently. Their eardrums registered the car pressurizing, and they heard a faint hiss of oxygen filtering in. Then they felt a shock of acceleration, which pressed them against their padded chair backs. A curving section of the forewall became transparent, stretching out to the sides. They saw the metal walls of a chute racing past and around them at a rate of speed none of them could estimate, but which was obviously very high. Overhead, light fixtures flicked by so fast that they combined with the intervals of darkness between them to acquire a strobing pattern. The bullet car burst out of the tunnel into the full, pink-hued daylight of Mars, and they all felt the lifting sensation in their bellies as they left the synthetic gravity field of the Cydonia compound. The track stretched out far ahead in a straight line, leading to the base of a mountain in the shape of a pyramid. All of them had seen the colossal structure before, but they gaped at it again, rendered speechless by awe. It loomed astonishingly high, its gigantic red walls climbing sheer toward the sky. They had to tilt their heads back to glimpse the apex, even though the pyramid was at least a mile away. The monolith was gargantuan, immensely broad at the base, covering a square mile and a half and tapering to a narrow top over 5,000 feet up. The enormous structure was only vaguely Egyptian in configuration, but so phenomenally huge that the Great Pyramid of Giza could have fit inside it. Unlike the classic Egyptian pentahedron design, the so-called D&M pyramid was a tetrahedron. The sheer size of the monument was almost too awesome to comprehend. It exuded antiquity, a history so incalculably ancient that the Pyramid of Giza had been built yesterday in comparison. Sunlight glinted faintly from a metal spire stretching from the pyramid's apex. It looked tiny and thread-like in relation to the structure supporting it, but he figured it had to be a minimum of 500 feet long, perhaps closer to 1,000. The side facing them bore a deep V-shaped symmetrical depression, extending the entire length of the pyramid from bottom to the conical top. Between the arms of the Great V, great flights of steps led up from the desert floor. The rail wound among bleak dunes that at times towered over the bullet car like giant ocean waves about to break above their heads.
This is so hard to believe.
That's for damn sure. But what are we going to do about them?
It required several seconds for the strangeness of Grant's query to penetrate the shock clouding their minds. Hitching around in their seats, they saw that Grant wasn't gaping at the enormous monument as they were. Instead, his attention was focused on what lay beyond the left side panel. Kane looked out onto the desolation of the Cydonia Plains. Far in the distance, he saw the squat, mesa-shaped rock formation, and on the horizon, sharp-pointed peaks arose, far too regular in shape to be mountains. Then a dark flitting movement caught his eye. He leaned forward over Bridget. Through the unearthly, pumpkin-tinted light, they saw long, slim craft swooping from the sky. Kane counted three of them as they skimmed with eye-blurring speed over the desert surface, sucking up plumes of grit in their wake. He recognized the craft as the bobsled-like objects he had seen in the compound.
Now we know what they are, and we can make our own guesses about the pilots.
They glimpsed helmeted and EVA-suited figures kneeling inside the flying sleds. One of the craft paced the bullet car, and the bulky figure within pointed an arm at them as if trying to wave them down. Little specks of light flashed and flickered from the end of the arm. Flares danced like lightning along the track ahead of them.
I get the feeling they don't think our trip is necessary.
A storm of shots struck the hull of the bullet car, banging like hailstones. They glimpsed the release of explosive energy, fiery flares bursting up at the impact points of the projectiles.
What kind of rounds are those?
Gyrojet rocket rounds, probably. Both Farrell and Filboid claimed McCann's forces used rocket pistols.
Through the transparent panels, they watched the three air sleds swoop headlong in a reckless swarm around the bullet car. The appearance of the attackers became clear. Their armored EVA suits covering them from head to toe gleamed dully like polished pewter. The visors of the helmets were completely opaque.
What the hell do they want? We can't stop this damn thing or even slow it down.
More explosive rounds hammered against the exterior of the conveyance, punching dents in the tough substance of the hull.
We should put on our helmets. If the cabin is breached, we'll depressurize fast.
All three of them did as she said, helping one another slip on the headpieces. Since the surface gravity of Mars was less than half that of Earth, and its atmospheric pressure only about 8 millibars, if the bullet car depressurized, they would die within minutes. Bridget, Kane, and Grant zipped up each other's collar attachments securely. While they were so occupied, the flying attackers loosed a hot barrage of fire at the rail on which they traveled. The bullet car zoomed over the notches and nicks, shuddering and rocking. Gazing at one of the sleds, Kane noted that its motive power appeared to be produced by a box-like machine at the stern.
If they derail us out here, we're deader than skinned scalies.
Kane and Bridget knew he spoke the truth. Although the outside temperature at noon could reach as high as 50 degrees Fahrenheit, it would plunge to around 200 degrees below zero at midnight. Neither the temperature controls of their EVA suits nor the shadow suits could handle that kind of extreme low temperature. Unbuckling the seat harness, Kane rose to his feet, stumbling slightly in the low gravity.
Baptiste, do you know how to open the hatch?
Bridget swept her gaze over the simplified control board and pointed to a pair of keys.
Here, I think. What do you plan on doing?
I don't have a plan, exactly. I just intend to stay alive. Grant, grab hold of my belt and don't let go. Why? Because even in this gravity, you weigh a lot more than me, and it makes you a perfect anchor.
Grant narrowed his eyes, wondering if he had been insulted or not, but then decided it made little difference. Still seated, he reached out and secured a tight grip on Kane's web belt with his left hand, keeping his gun hand free.
Open her up.
Bridget depressed one of the two keys, and the curving hatch slid aside. Kane reeled, trying to balance himself on the balls of his feet as the encapsulated atmosphere within the bullet car roared out onto the surface of Mars. He hadn't expected the rush of the wind to be so powerful. The tremendous velocity of the vehicle as it raced along the rail didn't help him to keep his balance either. The thin Martian air whipped at Kane's body, snatching at him, trying to yank him from the little car. With a muscle-straining effort, he stood spraddle-legged, jamming the sides of his boots firmly against the hatch frame.
You got me?
Got you.
Carefully, Kane crooked his elbow, bringing up his sin-eater. He couldn't extend the barrel of the weapon very far past the rim of the hatch due to the bullet car's speed. Cupping his right hand with his left, Kane brought the sled into target acquisition and pressed the trigger stud. He maintained his fingers' pressure, sending a long, stuttering burst toward the flying craft, doing what he could to account for windage. The stream of 9mm rounds stitched the side of the air sled with a pattern of holes, and then the block of machinery astern flamed up in a fierce, flaring explosion. The sled inscribed a crazed trajectory, like a meteor knocked off course. The sled lanced into the face of a dune, disappearing in a mushroom cloud of rust-hued grit. Braced against the bullet car's hatch, Kane felt the concussion of more rounds against the hull and even heard the detonations. Sand fountained up all around the rail, scouring the visor of Kane's helmet. He wiped the dirt away and saw a pair of sleds swoop past.
Missed us, dickheads.
He indulged in smug self-congratulation for all of 3 seconds. While his words still echoed within the walls of his helmet, another air sled skimmed into view, flying abreast of the bullet car. The armored figure kneeling within it raised a long, glittering object. The suffused sunlight glinted from the crystalline barrel of a quartz cremator. Frozen with sudden terror, Kane could only stand and stare with Grant's hand anchoring him in place. He waited for the scorching beam to cleave through his body as cleanly as a white-hot blade through paraffin. To his complete astonishment, the faceplate of the pilot's helmet suddenly burst outward in a shower of razor-edged shards amid a misting of blood. The EVA-suited figure flailed backward, arms flinging up and hurling the pulse plasma emitter over the sled's side and onto the Sidonia planes. The craft lost velocity and altitude. It dropped slowly, the blunt nose plowing a gouge in the sand. Face clammy with sweat, King turned his head to the right, looked down, and saw Bridget half prone on the deck, lying between his outstretched legs. The long barrel of the rail pistol in her fist protruded uncomfortably close to the juncture of his thighs.
Thanks.
Bridget backed away from between his legs.
My pleasure.
The bullet car continued to speed along the rail. King saw no more air sleds. In the distance, he was able to discern crumbling ruins around the foot of the immense pyramid. The structures were huge, but dwarfed by the monument. Walls had fallen in, and the stone blocks were scoured smooth by wind-blown sand. Craning his neck, he looked up, studying the long spire affixed to the pyramid's apex. Like an unimaginably huge needle, it seemed to pierce the wispy clouds.
Any sign? I think they got the idea to let us go on our way. Good. My arm is getting sore.
He released his grip on Kane's belt to massage his biceps. It hadn't been that long since his entire left side had been paralyzed, and he still exhibited occasional weaknesses in his arm and fingers. Before Kane could re-enter through the open hatch, an air sled roared up from the rear and slammed into the side of the bullet car. The prow battered it like the snout of a killer whale, sparks flying from the impact point. Jarred off balance, Kane teetered on the edge, arms windmilling. Then he toppled from the racing bullet car right onto the port side of the air sled. He landed hard enough to knock the breath from his lungs, and while he gasped in a mouthful of oxygen, he almost slid off. He drove the gloved fingers of his left hand between two rails of metal on the side, wedging them in far enough to secure a grip. The pilot turned around from the tiny control console and pointed a stunted blaster at Kane. The muzzle flashes flared like blossoming fluorescent tulips in the eerie sunlight. Bright brass arced out from the ejector port. Kane swiftly lowered his head, pulling it below the level of the sled's raised lip. Even as he ducked, he identified the gun in the pilot's hand as a decidedly unexotic Ingram M11 machine pistol. Judging by the shape and length of the clip, the weapon carried a 16-round box magazine. Due to its light recoil, the M11 had a very high cyclic rate of fire, and Kane guessed the EVA-suited pilot had just burned through half the magazine. Propping the barrel of his Sin-Eater on the edge of the sled rim, Kane squeezed off a tri-burst. Two of the shots went wild, but one of the bullets struck the pilot, throwing off a flare of sparks and ricocheting away from his armored shoulder epaulette. The kinetic shock knocked his body awkwardly to one side, and the air sled curved off in the same direction. Kane caught a fragmented glimpse of the pilot's knees fitting within a pair of upraised stirrup and cup contrivances bolted to the floor plate. The sled dived down and the pilot struggled to bring up its nose. Still, the craft dropped far enough so Kane's feet hit the ground with a painful jar he felt all the way into the base of his spine.
Kane, are you all right?
Don't I look all right?
If Bridget had a response, the sound of it was lost when the starboard side of the air sled scraped against the crest of a dune. The violent jounce nearly broke Kane's one-handed grip on the raised lip of the craft. For a long moment, he dangled by his left hand, feet hitting the desert floor with little puffs of rust-colored dust. He retracted his Sin-Eater into its forearm holster and heaved himself up enough so he could slap both hands around the raised edge of the sled. He pulled up his legs, trying to chin himself onto the deck. The undercarriage of the sled struck another dune, a glancing blow, bouncing Kane straight up, blinded by a pluming contrail of dust. He hung jackknifed over the side of the craft, his upper body on the deck, but his legs still dangling over the desert. A steady vibration ran through the chassis of the sled, and in the next few seconds, the flight leveled out, became smoother and faster. The sled flew rapidly upward in a wide spiral. The pilot threw the vehicle into a sudden whirl in the air, turning the craft upside down. Fighting back a cry of fright, Kane grabbed the rim and hung grimly on. He glanced down, seeing the bullet car still sliding along the track. He estimated it was about 50 feet below, but not getting farther away. He guessed the air sleds had definite ceilings, mechanical limitations on how high they could fly.
Hey, we're almost to the pyramid.
What do you want me to do about it?
I don't know, but you'd better do something and damn fast. Otherwise, you'll be stuck out here with your new friend.
The pilot rolled the sled back over and turned toward Kane, pointing the Ingram in a direct line with his helmet's faceplate. Kane looked into the stunted boar only inches away and came to a swift, almost insane decision. Flexing his wrist tendons, the Sin-Eater sprang into his hand, the long barrel smashing into the frame of the subgun at the same time the pilot squeezed the trigger. The Sin-Eater fired a tri-burst simultaneously, and the rounds from both weapons collided in mid-air as soon as they shot from their respective muzzles. Kane had no idea how many rounds screamed away Wild, but he knew that at least one grazed the top of his helmet. His ears rang with the chiming echo of the ricochet. The box-shaped machine at the stem of the skycraft suddenly jumped, parts of the dark casing flying away in flinders. He heard a brief buzz and concluded electromagnetic energy poured out of the shielded engine block. Oily black smoke curled from the seams, torn apart and scattered by the wind. He felt the buffet of escaping, expanding energies as the sled rocked violently. The craft flung itself on a wild, corkscrewing downward course. Kane could only hang on desperately, teeth gritted, stomach churning. The pilot frantically worked at the control console, and the sled achieved a more or less stable attitude, but still followed a steadily declining trajectory. Glancing down, Kane saw the bullet car and track almost directly below. He pushed himself away from the craft and fell. He fanned his arms as he plummeted downward. In the lesser gravity, it felt as if he'd dropped for a disquietingly long time. Then, when he hit the flat car squarely with the soles of his feet, he decided he hadn't fallen long enough.
That's one way to do it.
Hey, we're almost there. Get back inside.
He craned his neck, scanning the sky for the air sled, and saw it flutter out of sight on the far side of a hill, trailing a banner of smoke. Kane forced himself to his feet, breath rasping in and out of his straining lungs as he staggered to the rear of the bullet car and climbed along its hull. He fell into the cabin and allowed Grant and Bridget to deposit him in a chair.
Just in time. Thought you were going to be left behind.
Yeah. And that would have been a damn shame.
As the bullet car came closer to the pyramid, they saw the great cavity that occupied a large portion of the base. High heaps of debris were piled on either side of it. The track disappeared into the hole. They knew the cavity was the result of explosive penetration made during the Archon attack on the Danann outpost. McCann claimed Balaam himself had led the assault. The bullet car plunged quietly into the cavity. Lights shone intermittently overhead, small splotches of illumination that did little to alleviate the deep shadows. The track tilted upward at a gradual incline until it reached a 90-degree slant. The speed of the vehicle didn't slacken. After a couple of minutes, the track angle decreased in sharpness until the car rode straight and smooth again. Through the forepart, they saw walls constructed of individual stone blocks, three times the size of the vehicle that carried them. The bullet car's speed dropped rapidly until it slid to a halt beside a broad platform. The bullet car darkened inside as the forepart went opaque. They all disembarked onto the platform, noting how heavy their bodies felt compared to the trip across the plains. During their first visit, Sindri had claimed that this particular level of the pyramid had been adjusted to accommodate humans, complete with synthetic gravity generators and oxygen circulation pumps. With a clanking of gears, the section of rail supporting the car rotated on a hidden pivot, turning it around 180 degrees so it faced the way they had come. They looked around, not seeing any change since the last time they had been there. Grim walls of gray-red cyclopean stone surrounded them. They knew all the levels of the pyramid were immense. Sindri had speculated that different strata of Danann society occupied the levels, perhaps with their own customs and dialects.
Do we want to do this with or without our helmets?
Without. It makes it easier to see if anybody is trying to sneak up on us.
The three Outlanders opened the seals and latch flanges of one another's helmets. They tentatively lifted them off, sniffing the air experimentally. Although cold, it smelled fresh. Their breath steamed before their eyes, so they figured the temperature was balmy by Martian standards. Attaching the helmets to their backstraps, they entered a wide corridor lit by wall-bracketed neon tubes, passing through a series of triangular archways. Cut into the stone above each one was a plate-sized spiral glyph, the same kind of cup-and-spiral design that served as something of an unofficial emblem of the Tuatha De Danann. The floor slanted slightly upward, and the stone blocks were worn smooth as if by the pressure of many feet. The arches opened occasionally to the left and right, but the Outlanders kept to the main corridor. Presently, a brighter light glimmered in the murk just beyond a tall arch.
Do you think Micah Harwin is still alive, still tending to the transmitter?
It's possible, but I don't think it's likely.
And you would be so right.
Then they heard a laugh, a rising and falling titter with a hint of a sob. The laugh was full of bitterness and even a touch of self-pity, underscored by a note of hysteria.
McCann.
None other. Just as I expected.
And just as I hoped.
Three figures emerged from an archway behind them.
I'm so glad to hear that. A reunion is so much more joyous when all parties involved are happy to see one another. And I can't express how delighted I am to see you again.